You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 13 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I am Tristan Carcino.
And a busy week in Seattle sports. A lot going on.
Yeah, should we start with... Actually, I want to start with the Mariners.
Yeah, I think so. Keith Urban had a nice piece yesterday on his show about the two Seattles, about how you have the Seahawks, who are, you know, atop the NFC. Everyone loves them. Sold out games. Most loudest fans in the NFL. And then you have the Mariners, who...
I didn't see that particular segment. I heard about it a little bit. But that's really interesting that Keith Olbermann was talking about the Mariners on his show.
Well, in the context of Robinson Cano, the report yesterday from ESPNNewYork.com that the Mariners are serious players, I believe, was the term for Cano's services, is the marquee free agent on the market, expected to command somewhere in the neighborhood of, say, $200 million over 10 years.
The reports seem to be that the Mariners would be willing to offer Robinson Cano $200 million over 8 years, I believe.
Well, we've seen this before where the Mariners have been in on, you know, Josh Hamilton last year.
So I had a concern about this. Let me just say, first off, I don't know if I consider myself a Mariners fan. I know that you don't.
I certainly don't.
You consider yourself a Mariners hater.
You know, I refuse to support the organization on philosophical grounds.
Last year, I felt like I was a Mariners fan. In the strange sense last winter, and I wanted them to sign Josh Hamilton, but they really weren't willing to make a legit offer to Josh Hamilton. And it seems to me like right now the Mariners are willing to outbid anybody for Robinson Cano.
I don't know. I mean, I think they were willing to make a serious offer. 2 years ago, Prince Fielder was the guy who was in this similar position. Yeah. But, you know, a team like the Angels can just come in and trump that bid. And I think that, you know, it's likely the same scenario with the Yankees in that role this time. And this seems to largely be an effort to kind of scare up some interest in Cano and raise his value.
It could be. So I was reading the story earlier on ESPN Insider. That's a little shout out to you. On the Rumor Central, and I was talking about Robinson Cano and the potential of the Mariners. But it also mentioned, Seattle has also been mentioned as a possible trade partner with the Los Angeles Dodgers for Matt Kemp.
That's interesting.
That would make me much more excited.
Would there be an outside chance of Rihanna coming to Mariners games in that case?
Are they reunited?
I don't know. I think that's
very old news.
Well, I like that.
But Matt Kemp is my absolute favorite baseball player and the natural predecessor to Ken Griffey Jr.
Predecessor means you come before.
The natural successor to Ken Griffey Jr. He would captivate Seattle like no player has since Ichiro's first season, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, if he's healthy and productive like he was a couple of years ago.
More so than Robinson Cano, even.
A great deal.
So my question for you, and I'll answer this also, because I think I know what your answer is going to be, is if the Mariners were to somehow sign Robinson Cano, would you be interested? If they were to sign Matt Kemp, would you be interested? This is in the team in general. If they were to sign both, what would it take?
I would be mildly interested if they got Kemp. I just know so little about Robinson Cano as a totally casual baseball fan who barely pays any attention. Kemp I know about because he's more like in the cultural zeitgeist.
You don't think Robinson Cano is in the cultural zeitgeist?
Not in the same way as Matt Kemp.
It's really strange to me because I consider both of them like my two favorite baseball players.
So you should want them not to come to the Mariners. You should not wish that.
Well, I could go and see. I wanted to go see Matt Kemp when the Dodgers played here, but he wasn't playing. So I didn't buy tickets to go see Matt Kemp. But if he was here, I could go see Matt Kemp sometimes, if he were to ever be healthy.
I mean, I think there would definitely be some mild interest, but obviously my stance on the Mariners as an organization will not change unless they back off their anti-Sonics Arena position or ownership and Howard Lincoln changes. Even Chuck Armstrong's retirement doesn't really do anything for me because I don't think he's behind that. I think that's entirely Howard Lincoln.
That's interesting. Well, I guess your philosophical anger toward the Mariners, it's all philosophical, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even care about how bad the team is.
Mine is just lack of interest in the team.
I watched the Huskies when they were 0-12.
Mine is the normal Mariner lack of interest.
Yes.
Yours is just the Sonics base lack of interest.
I'm surprised there's not more of that, though, because there's enough crossover between Mariners and Sonics fans that it seemed like their position was really telling Sonics fans, their own fans, we don't care what you think. We only care about ourselves.
I mean, I feel that also.
And insulting their intelligence in the process by claiming, oh, it's about traffic and all sorts of, you know, whatever ridiculous positions they're taking.
I feel that also. I just don't think that the Mariners' position matters. I don't care.
Maybe
I don't care about the front
help.
Office. I only care about the players.
Well, there might be some new ones then.
Well, that's an interesting conversation to come back to when something happens there. I feel like something might happen soon.
I don't know. I feel like the Cano thing, if it could be a waiting game. Although this year's baseball offseason, it seems like everything is getting done at warp speed.
But let's talk about the Husky coaching change and potential Husky football coaching search.
I mean, I think it definitely is a search at this point. I hope so. I mean, the reports today that they were Scott Woodward was meeting with Marcus Tuiasosopo, and then also that Justin Wilcox was going to get an interview. Obviously, moving on to Plan B after Jim Mora turned them down yesterday and signed a new six-year deal to stay at UCLA, and you know. For those people like yourself that had all their eggs in the Jim Mora basket, a pretty devastating result.
You know what's weird? So I went down the Jim Mora wormhole all morning.
Jim Mora wormhole.
I got myself so hyped up on Jim Mora. I was expecting at any point yesterday for there to be a Jim Mora hiring announcement. I was so convinced. I think I told you this in the morning that I felt confident that Jim Mora was coming here. The way that he wasn't saying anything, I thought was a good sign. Turned out it was a bad sign.
I mean, that's the beauty of him saying nothing, is you can interpret it any way you want.
It really is true. It just all felt so natural, and it felt like the whole conversation online was that Mora was going to come to UW. There are so many sources, right? Somebody tweeted this, but I was just like searching for Jim Mora on Twitter, and there were so many people who had sources close to
It turns out it was actually Jim Mora, his dad.
Jim
that
Mora,
was the closest sources. Well,
people who had sources close to the universities who had like 12 followers. And I click on their page and I was like, okay, I do not trust this person's sources. That's good source, Jim Mora coming to UW. And I was like, all right. And then I click on it and he's got 9 followers.
Like, that's a good rule of thumb. Before retweeting, check to see whether they have more than 9 followers.
But I got so sucked into Jim Mora that when near the middle of the day they announced that Jim Mora was staying at UCLA, I was like weirdly devastated by this.
I think that was the common reaction among Husky fan base.
I never thought that I would be so excited about Jim Mora as a coach of my team. And I actually had some reservations when I was getting excited about it. I went through the whole range of emotions. But I was so excited about it that it was like, who are we going to get now? There's no other option. And then, crazily enough, while I was driving here, I was listening to the Brock and Danny show, and they were talking about Chris Peterson, and I did the same thing all over again.
This could happen multiple times during the coaching search. Are you prepared for that?
I have talked myself into Chris Peterson, and here's why. Chris Peterson is probably a better coach on the field than Jim Mora.
Yeah.
Probably better coach than Steve Sarkisian.
I think so.
Chris Peterson at a much smaller college with much fewer recruiting resources has put way more players in the NFL.
Yeah.
And that's something that he can show to future recruits. Look, here are all these first-round picks, and that's at Boise State. He's got Doug Martin, Kyle Wilson, tons of players, and successful players in the NFL, too. He knows Washington right now better than Coach Sark does, and probably better than Jim Mora does. He might not have the lasting relationships that Jim Mora has, but he's got some relationships. Also, this is the fourth thing on my list for Chris
Peterson. I'm pretty sure you stole that argument from what I said on the podcast.
I know. I was talking you into Jim Mora, now I'm trying to talk you into Chris Peterson. I might not need to do that. Fourth, Justin Wilcox being his defensive coordinator at Boise State means there's a relationship there. And to me, one of the main things with this coaching search is figuring out a way to either, I don't know if I want Justin Wilcox as the head coach, but keeping him involved with the program and figuring out a way to keep the rest of that defensive staff.
See, that's why I was talking myself into the Nussmeier-Justin Wilcox combination.
I think that's a really exciting combination, too. It's like, if Peterson says no, my next best choice is Nussmeier as head coach, Wilcox as defensive coordinator slash assistant head coach, some sort of elevated role beyond defensive coordinator, and a promise that they're going to help him develop into a head coach.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in agreement here. You know, I would be surprised at this point to see the Huskies go for a kind of mid-major candidate and established head coach from, you know, like an up-and-coming head coach.
Tim DeRuiter,
even James Franklin, obviously, in a major conference. But I just don't see them going for that type of hire at this point.
No, it's not a very UW thing to do.
It seems like it's, which is funny because it is what they did with Don James.
It's true. That was a long time ago.
I have some more thoughts on that. But yeah, it seems like it's either going to be Chris Peterson or promoting someone who is at the coordinator level.
And elevating somebody from the coordinator level, I know this hasn't turned out particularly great, but I was thinking, it's not something that, like, a small college does all the time. If you look at Florida when Urban Meyer left, they hired Will Muschamp, who...
And that's worked great.
Well, that's what I was saying. It didn't work out well. But they did hire kind of the next coordinator up, and it didn't... nobody questioned that decision. You know, and Doug Nussmeier has been working at the biggest school in the country. He's been working with Nick Saban on recruiting.
Yeah, hopefully something has rubbed off there. But I think this gets back to my point, which is none of us know. We have no idea. Like, there are going to be
That's
such...
That's a really, really boring podcast. we'll see what happens.
I think I could express it in an interesting way, hopefully.
None of us know.
I mean, there's going to be such strong opinions. Whoever gets hired at some point here in the next few days or maybe next week, there's going to be such strong opinions. People are going to tell you, oh, this is the next Don James. And then some people are going to tell you, this is the next Tyrone Willingham. And half of them are going to be right, and half of them are going to be wrong. Or maybe, as was the case with Sark... all of them are going to be slightly wrong, and it's actually going to be somewhere in between.
Yeah, but I would hope that there's something in between.
Yeah, there's a pretty enormous middle ground between those. But, you know, for a couple coaching hires to come back to. The Don James hire, as we talked about when he passed away in our kind of tribute to him, he's coming off of, like, an 8-4 season at Kent State. Imagine in the Twitter era, if the Huskies were to now hire the modern equivalent of Don James, like... you know, someone who's got a third-place team in the MAC, I think Twitter would actually explode if that happened. And then the other one I've been thinking about is Pete Carroll. When Pete Carroll was hired by USC, we talked about this a little bit, people were pretty down on him based on his tenure with the Patriots. Like, there was some thought, he definitely had his backers, people that thought that he would transition better to the college level and make more sense there than he did as a pro coach. But there was a lot of uncertainty about that hire. He was maybe the third choice because both Dennis Erickson and Mike Bellotti both got extensions out of that one.
Dennis Erickson.
Those were apparently their first two choices. And they were debating between him and Mike Riley, who was then the coach of the Chargers. So, you know, and then he turned out to be, you know, one of the most successful modern college football coaches of all time. So you never know.
So a couple coaches who are coming from small jobs and kind of unsuccessful jobs, like Don James we were talking about, the two different Auburn coaches of the last decade, there's Gene Chizik coming from Iowa State, coming off a 2-10 season, somehow getting that job. I remember Charles Barkley being furious about that.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, leading them to the national championship.
But he was furious because he wanted the guy that got hired at Nebraska, right?
I thought it was the coach of Buffalo.
Yeah, and he ended up at Nebraska and... or Kansas, Turner Gill, and ended up running the Kansas program into the ground. Again, you have no idea.
It's true, you have no idea. But then also Gus Malzahn, who had a good record at the very least, but was at Arkansas State for one season before he was the head coach of Auburn, and now they're 11-1 playing in the SEC championship game.
And that's kind of similar to the Nussmeier route, I would say, with the exception of it was nice in Malzahn's case that he had some head coaching experience to go on before he got to Auburn, even if it was only 1 year. But
Nussmeier is a little bit younger also, and he's 42, so that's kind of nice. He's young and fresh. He's from Portland and went to Idaho. It seems like Nussmeier's a good option here.
Oh, do you feel like Gary Pinkel is in this mix at all?
I don't think so. He's been at Missouri for so long. I feel like he's going to be at Missouri until he's either fired or retires.
Especially at his age, 61, it seems like an odd time to make this kind of enormous change.
He's not the type of coach who I even want. You know, like if we're going to get an established coach... there are other coaches that I think I would want besides Gary Pinkel, somebody with a little bit more energy, somebody like Chris Peterson.
I mean, I think I would be okay with it just because he's, a very successful coach,
yeah,
and B, the UW ties, again, you know, the natural Don James successor kind of thing. I mean, I think I would be excited about it, but I just don't see a scenario where it happens.
Does Doug Nussmeier, his similarities, because he bears a lot of similarities to Coach Sark, do his similarities to Coach Sark make you more positive or less positive about him?
I don't know. I mean, I think that Coach Sark is a good football coach. I mean, I think there were some questions about, you know, how he handled his relationships with the media and things like that. And hopefully, you know, Nussmeier has a different approach to those kind of things if he is indeed the guy.
He doesn't quite have the reputation that Sark had as being a quarterback whisperer or something like that. But his route is very similar. It's almost shockingly similar.
I guess more time in the NFL, right?
There are probably a lot of guys like this out there who played in the NFL as backups and then went and became coaches. So maybe it's not uncommon to have somebody like this, but it's kind of shocking just to see that being an offensive coordinator at a major program, basically the biggest program in the country, playing in the NFL, going to college in, I guess, the Northwest area. I don't know if I call BYU the Northwest, but playing college in the area and having a relationship with Washington.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that, the parallels there.
If we could basically put together the two second-best choices after Chris Peterson, if Chris Peterson is out, because that's what I'm all in on now,
mm-hmm.
If we could put together the two second-best choices, Nussmeier and Wilcox, I think that would be a nice mix.
Mm-hmm. One wild card to throw in there that I heard online, I hadn't considered at all, Ray Horton.
Yeah, that's what I heard mentioned. I mean, I would love Ray Horton. I don't know if I see him going to college, though.
It seems unlikely.
Ray Horton, and he's the current defensive coordinator of the Cleveland Browns right now. One of the best defensive coordinators in the NFL.
Did great work with the Cardinals, and I think one of the season's biggest surprises is that the Cardinals have kept it up without him.
I was unaware that he went to UW. I actually did not know that.
It was so far before our time.
So I guess that makes sense why he's a potential option. I mean, if they could hire Ray Horton, they should do that. I would be all in on that.
Where would you would rank that? Would you rank that ahead of Chris Peterson?
I would rank it close to Chris Peterson. Huh. But Ray Horton he's next in line very soon for an NFL head coaching job, right? I don't see him wanting to come back to college and be a college head coach.
Yeah, it'd have to be some sort of unrealized dream that he hadn't, you know, he hadn't told KJR about while he was the head coach of the Falcons. But I do want to talk about that, and I think that people are kind of devastated, like, what, this wasn't Jim Mora's dream job, or is this a sign that UW is not a step up from UCLA, or is a step down from UCLA? And, you know, I think one of the things we have to remember is, just because something is your dream job doesn't mean it's your dream job right now. And I think the scenario that I want to draw on is the USC job was open 3 years ago. After, I think it was Sark's second season at UW, and instead he signed an extension instead of becoming a legitimate candidate for that job when it went to Lane Kiffin. And there's no objective reason why it's a better job 3 years later, except that maybe you're not following in the footsteps of Pete Carroll, and that would have been a really difficult thing to do.
Well, and you're farther removed from the sanctions.
That's all. Yeah, that is true. That's probably a piece of it. But
was he offered that job?
I mean, I don't think he ever got to that point. It was like when Mora was with the Seahawks, and he probably could have had the UW job when it went to Sark, but never just got to that point. But, you know, it was still his dream job. It just wasn't the right time for it. Mm-hmm. And this, in his opinion, was the right time. So I don't think that, like, it closes the door to Mora ever coaching at UW.
I was just going to say that it closes the door to Mora ever coaching at UW. That's the way that I feel about this. Softy tweeted this yesterday, and it was right after the announcement of the Mora extension came out. Time to end all this UW was Jim Mora's dream job stuff. He had two chances at the job, said no twice. Clearly, it wasn't that special to him. And that might have been sour grapes, but I actually agree with him. I think when Jim Mora was saying that he was joking, he might have just been caught up in the moment in that interview years ago. But this was the right time. I mean, there's the Seattle Times article. There's no other way to perceive this as not being the right time for Jim Mora.
But he was 2 years into the job at UCLA, had just started building a lot of momentum there. I don't know why I'm talking about this in the past tense. Sorry, to yesterday. But it's a situation where you feel a little bit like you're leaving UCLA in the lurch. And I think that, like, in Sark's case, I think part of it was he could feel better about where he was leaving the UW program now than he could have in 2010.
I don't think that either of them care about that. I think that Sark would have gone to USC anytime he was offered the USC job. And I think that Jim Mora
obviously wouldn't.
It's true. Jim Moore just didn't feel the same way about UW that Sark felt about USC. Does that make sense?
I don't know. I'm still not. I think timing is a factor. I'm just going to leave it
I agree that timing is the factor, but I think that this is the perfect timing for Jim Moore. After this, we're not even going to bring him up as an option.
I think that's your perspective, and that may be different from his perspective.
For Jim Moore. But I'm saying organizationally, from the program, I don't...
Yeah, but again, that's from UW's perspective. That's not from Jim Moore's perspective. And those perspectives
he's just
going to
take the job
align.
If he's not offered it?
Well, I mean, I just don't think that, you know, if there is a coaching search in, you know, 5 years and Jim Moore is unhappy at UCLA, I don't think that
he
should be off the list because of this. Like,
I
you
would
didn't
say,
take it now? No, you're never getting the job. I don't think that's...
If I had to bet right now, I would say Jim Moore will never be the head coach of UW football.
Well, I would bet against it as well.
I mean, I'd bet against almost anybody being the head coach of anything.
Yeah.
But I would bet against myself being the head coach of UW football team.
Well, I would bet a lot of money against that. if you were to give me good enough odds, I would perhaps consider it as a long shot.
But I do think that it kind of takes him off the table. And the way that we've been hung up on Jim Moore for so long, even earlier this year talking about it, as opposed to Sark, I think that we kind of have to end that conversation.
True. I mean, if I'm a UCLA fan and I'm looking at this, like, I feel like I've dodged the biggest possible bullet with Jim Moore leaving.
What if you're a UCLA fan who doesn't think Jim Moore is a good coach?
Well, then I haven't seen many of those online. That's a distinctly minority position, but then I guess you're unhappy.
I mean, it creates an interesting thing in Southern California right now between Coach Sark and Jim Moore, kind of recruiting battles. I think it creates an interesting dynamic there. Both of them have relationships to the Northwest, and it all ends up terrible for the Huskies.
Yeah. That is true.
But there was... Did you listen to the Pete Carroll morning show yesterday?
I did not, sadly.
Pete Carroll was so eloquent when talking about Coach Sark going to USC that I was like, have fun, buddy.
Pete Carroll talked you into it.
And, I mean, he was like, oh, Coach Sark is so excited. You know, he worked really hard to get to that point. He really cares about those kids. He was talking about him knowing everything about Southern California football, that he's like an expert on Southern California football more than anybody Pete Carroll had ever met, and that it was a really tough decision for him. And they talked, obviously, and that he really, really liked UW, but it was just, he was such knowledge on USC football, and that was where he wanted to be, and that's where he wants to stay. And I was like, Pete Carroll's excited about this, I'm going to be excited about it.
So that's what we need, is whoever the coach ends up being, a Pete Carroll endorsement, and we're good to go.
I mean, don't you agree with that?
Yeah.
Knowing that Pete Carroll and the potential new coach are friends and talking always makes you feel good.
And we just need to make sure that Russell Wilson is mentoring whoever, as Siler Miles or whoever's next in line. Keep that relationship going as well.
So I guess, should we talk chances really quick of anybody, or just leave it out there?
I don't know. It's such an impossible thing to handicap.
Since we both agree that Chris Peterson is our first choice.
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are that Chris Peterson were to jump?
I'd say like 1 in 5 at best, maybe like 1 in 10.
I was going to say 20% also.
Yeah.
It's so much harder when you do 1 in blah. That's not a percent chance. I mean, I guess it is. But I do think that it's about a 20% chance, maybe even less than that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's likely. I think that if Chris Peterson is ever going to jump, this might be the time. It might not ever happen after this.
I would just say, if you're a UW fan, don't put all your eggs in the Chris Peterson basket.
What about, so there's just this quote here that USC doesn't want to pay the full buyout for Justin Wilcox. What about Justin Wilcox sticking around at the program in some capacity?
I think that's great.
Do you think, what are the chances?
Oh, the chances? I think it's better than 50-50.
I agree. I think there's a good chance that no matter who the head coach is, whether it might be Wilcox also,
yeah.
Whether it is Wilcox or not, I think there's a good chance that he sticks around as defensive coordinator. And really, to me, as far as the coaching staff goes, on the coaching side, I think that Wilcox and the defensive staff have advanced past the offensive staff at this point.
Yeah, that's one of the things I found when I did my analysis of the program, is that this is the first time the defense has been ahead of the offense since the Rose Bowl season.
Well, last year they were.
Oh, yeah, last year. The last 2 years, yes.
Last year they were significantly better than the offense. So it feels to me like keeping Wilcox and as much of the defensive staff as possible around, it seems like Wilcox and Lupoy and Sermon are kind of a team together.
I can see Lupoi leaving. I don't know.
Well, that was also part of this tweet, was that USC was willing to pay the $400,000 buyout for Lupoi. And he could get a more elevated role at USC.
But certainly Wilcox and Sermon are a package deal at this point, I think you would have to say. And yeah, I think that's the most positive development since Monday. In the midst of the very depressing Jim Mora turning UW down, the good news is Wilcox potentially staying when it looked like he was a goner as of Monday.
That's true. That's true. Okay, so there's a lot on UW football. If there is a hire within the next 2 to 3 days before we next record, let's do a special one-off head coach podcast.
We'll have to make sure that the Skype recording is still working.
I'm also nervous that next week we might have to record on Skype because of snow.
Oh, I didn't even consider that.
I'm nervous about it. I think there's a serious potential of snow in Western Washington.
It's a very real threat.
And we could be trapped inside our houses. But let's talk about some more positive news. A place where everything is going right.
The other Seattle, as Keith Overman would put it.
On the Seahawks with an awesome 34-7 victory over the Saints on Monday Night Football.
I think they played well. I was happy with their performance.
So I was at the game, you were not. But I want to talk about the noise really quick. I asked you if you could hear that it was really loud on TV, and obviously they broke the noise record again. They took it back from the Chiefs this season.
Which I hope doesn't become a thing where it's just going back and forth every game. That would get annoying.
I agree. It seems like, to me, most Seahawks fans are unconcerned with the noise record at this point.
Yeah.
We know we're loud.
We don't need anything to prove it.
It's true. But did it seem loud on the TV?
I mean, it seemed loud, but I don't know. It's not like you can gauge it via TV the same way you can in person.
I think during the Bennett touchdown was the loudest it was, but it didn't feel, the magnitude didn't feel as big, that was a pun, the magnitude didn't feel as big as that 49ers game at the beginning of the season. It might have been because the Seahawks came out and kind of stomped the Saints so early.
Yeah, it took a couple quarters for the stomping to happen against San Francisco.
But it didn't feel like the crowd... I mean, the crowd was obviously into it, but it wasn't as loud as it was at that 49ers game, and as I would assume it would be for any potential home playoff games.
See, that didn't seem to be the reaction from people on the sidelines and that sort of thing.
I thought that was a strange conversation after that. I don't know why I didn't think... I wasn't impressed with how loud it was.
Your standards have been set way too
very
high.
Very different expectations. It was just that 49ers game. It was a deafening roar when they were on offense. And at this game, it was loud to begin the game, but it wasn't that just like... that overwhelming roar, like, you can't hear anything, you can't hear yourself.
Or you, like, came home with a headache from it, right?
Yeah. But let's talk about the game really quick. We talked beforehand and said that the Seahawks would be running the ball a lot. Clearly the Saints heard that game plan.
They did. They were obviously listening to the Pelton Browns.
And really loaded up against the run, and that meant that Russell Wilson had one of the best games of his entire career.
Yeah, I mean, the Seahawks came out with a brilliant game plan. They were so prepared for this after the bye week, and one of the things they were anticipating is, you know, the Saints were doing that, so it's a little game theory at play. If you expect us to run, and we expect you expect us to run, we're going to try and pass. And Russell Wilson was just phenomenal. I don't know how you can play a much better game than he did on Sunday. Standing in there against the pressure at times, that eight-man blitz that they brought at one point where he hit the deep ball to Doug Baldwin, the touch on the play action to Zach Miller for the 60-yard completion. He was phenomenal. And then also the read option as well.
Yeah, he had a great game. And I think that maybe it wasn't even necessarily the game plan going in that they would pass more. It was just, we're going to take whatever they give us. We've kind of reached that point. People talk about that with Peyton Manning when he's doing the check with me at the line. It's just like, if you're going to give us the run, we're going to run the ball. And that's what they did against the Patriots, and O'Shawn Moreno was over 200 yards. In this case, it was like, if you're going to load up, Russell's going to either check to a different play or we're going to call a play because we see that this is happening, where we're going to pass the ball.
I mean, we saw MVP caliber Russell Wilson on Sunday night, and I think it ranks up there is one of his three best games. I'm not sure how I'd rank these, but... with the playoff game in Atlanta and then the comeback win in Chicago, I think are his three best performances.
So I was thinking about this on the way here. Our offense, the Seahawks offense, probably has the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to thank. Right?
I mean, I suppose.
Last season, they really started clicking in that Chicago game. Right? Yeah. And from there, didn't stop.
Situation where you're forced to pass in a comeback scenario.
This season... it was being down against Tampa Bay, having to come back in that game, and the offense hasn't stopped since then.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, people will point to the offensive line, obviously, but it started with the Atlanta game, even the second half of that Tampa Bay game.
Yeah, two games without the full offensive line. Having them all back is really nice, though.
It is helpful. It was good to see Russell Wilson not get knocked down constantly.
But so we were there, and then on the defensive side of the ball, the Seahawks just stifling defense against the Saints receivers and Drew Brees. Basically giving up nothing on the ground. Mark Ingram had 8 carries for 22 yards, and then no impact at all from any of the receivers. There was a lot of checking down to Darren Sproles, but I was mentioning that on the preview, is that the Seahawks defend that really well, and they gave up 4.6 yards per carry to Sproles there.
And without demeaning the
secondary, yards per reception.
Without demeaning the secondary, because they did a phenomenal job with Byron Maxwell and Jeremy Lane filling in for the suspensions and injuries, but the Seahawks linebackers were out of control on Monday night. That was by far the best game we've seen from that crew. And that's another thing that goes back to the second half of that Tampa Bay game. A shift since then. Linebackers have been playing far better in coverage, shutting down the run, and really taking this defense from a point where it's a good but maybe vulnerable a little bit, has some weaknesses defense, to one where New Orleans could not find anything to attack, really, other than maybe penalties.
Yeah, there were no holes there, really, since they say that Ken Norton challenged the linebackers. Yeah. Charlie, so we mentioned, why didn't he do that at the beginning of the season? Ken Norton should have been challenging the linebackers a long time ago. But if they have the ability to play like that for the rest of the season, I don't know if I can see the Seahawks losing another game.
By the way, how is Ken Norton still a linebackers coach? How has no one offered this guy a defensive coordinator job or even the Husky head coaching job? I mean, like, seriously. Like, he was an all-time great player, has learned under Pete Carroll. His units have been phenomenal given the lack of resources expended on them and the youth at the position. I mean, Bruce Irvin's been playing linebacker for, like, what, 5 months now? And he's out there in coverage making plays? It's terrific.
Yeah, he should get. I don't want him to get a defensive coordinator
job. Ken Norton, underrated. Official Fabulous Pelton guest, shout out to
him. Shout out. I mean, it was interesting. They didn't really even consider him for the defensive coordinator job here. It didn't look like when Dan Quinn came out after Gus Bradley left.
Yeah, I mean, if Quinn were to leave, I think maybe then he'd be the next in line.
But he's such a good linebackers coach that you want him to stay there.
We can still talk to the linebackers. It's like Pete Carroll is still a good defensive coordinator even when he's the head coach.
But I thought K.J. Wright played, and I think we might have mentioned this 2 or 3 weeks in a row, K.J. Wright played one of the best games of his entire career.
Yeah.
They gave up nothing in that intermediate range.
Yeah, he was the most active, I think, of the linebackers.
So the third quarter was winding down, and I was looking at the clock, and there was, I don't know, under a minute left in the third quarter. And then I looked at how many passing yards Drew Brees had, and he was under 100 passing yards. I was like, when do you think the last time Drew Brees was under 100 passing yards going to the fourth quarter was?
Well, that's something they were tracking pretty closely on the broadcast, and especially with his streak of, you know, consecutive 200 yards games that ended up getting broken as he finished with 147.
And it was generally considered that this is the worst game he played since 2006.
That's a long time.
Yeah. So the defense at every level, and you know what, did not even notice, I feel, the lack of Walter Thurman and Brandon Browner at all.
No, not at all.
So our confidence in Jeremy Lane and Byron Maxwell paid off.
Yeah, I mean, it was justified. We'd seen it before. I don't think it was stunning. I think it was just people that didn't know, you know, how well they'd played in the past that were really concerned about.
So speaking of the secondary, we turn to a game where they might be challenged again this coming week with the San Francisco 49ers.
Well, I think that San Francisco's game plan will probably be to try to run the ball first and foremost with Frank Gore, but now they've finally got something approximating a real core of wide receivers. Now that they've got Michael Crabtree back in the lineup last week, you know, Manningham's been back for a while, and then to go with Anquan Boldin.
I really think that Michael Crabtree really transforms what the 49ers do. The amount of scariness that I feel from the 49ers has increased significantly with him back. Vernon Davis is having a good season. Anquan Boldin's having a great season. They're both at 64% catch rate, one of the best wide receivers and tight ends in the NFL. And just the 49ers have not been able to find that third wide receiver.
Yeah, and what the Seahawks were able to do is really focus on taking out Anquan Boldin out of the game in week two. Obviously, that was when Sherman shadowed him around the field so famously. But you probably can't focus on him as exclusively this time around, assuming that Crabtree is close to full strength.
Absolutely. And so I was looking at the snap counts for the 49ers wide receiver for the whole season, and two of their top five wide receivers and snaps are no longer with the team anymore. They had Kyle Williams, who they cut, and then also Marlon Moore, who they cut. They haven't been able to find anything at all, and with Crabtree back, this opens everything up. Being able to push Manningham down to a number three wide receiver and potentially John Baldwin, it really, really transforms what they're doing, and it's going to put a lot of pressure on the Seahawks.
It puts guys in their proper places, I think, is the biggest thing it does. And, you know, Kaepernick has almost had tunnel vision, I think, this year, looking for Bolden and Davis, understandably so. That those are the guys that he has the most trust with. So now this gives him a couple other options there, and you can't focus in quite the same way.
On their first week back, or in their first week with Crabtree, his first week back, he had a 60-yard reception, just four targets, so he wasn't getting probably the same kind of action that he'll get long-term. And Colin Kaepernick and Michael Crabtree last season had a really good relationship when they were both playing together. Crabtree was his number one target. Anquan Bolden still got a lot of targets, 13, nine catches for 98 yards. But I think it's going to be a real test for that Seahawks secondary going forward with having three legit wide receiver options.
Do you feel like Colin Kaepernick is good enough to win a shootout with the Seahawks in that kind of fashion?
Absolutely not.
I mean, he did it in week one against Green Bay. So we have seen him do it before, but since then he's been very up and down.
Yeah, Colin Kaepernick to me is right now he's playing like a mediocre quarterback. Colin Kaepernick is a solid rushing quarterback. His accuracy is a little bit poor. He has a tendency to make some crazy decisions. He made the bad decision against the Saints that basically lost the 49ers that game. If you have to compare him to Russell Wilson, when he throws the ball downfield, is the perfect quarterback. I mean, we talked about that earlier. When they're forced to pass, the Seahawks don't do anything wrong, basically.
You know, when he had that incompletion on the deep ball, too, I think it was Golden Tate up the left sideline. Like, I assumed at first that Golden Tate got held, that could be the only way that could have happened.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the top quarterbacks in the league completion percentage, Colin Kaepernick's at 57% and Russell Wilson's at 65%. It's a pretty significant difference there.
But surprisingly, he's eighth in QBR, which, you know, it's a little tough to figure out how much of that is the clutch element that goes into it, but the rushing element is still positive, and then that may also be accounting for the fact that he hasn't gotten much help this year, obviously from his receiving core, but also from his offensive line.
And the Seahawks haven't faced too many like rushing quarterbacks this season. I know they gave up at least one long scramble to Andrew Luck and a couple to Ryan Fitzpatrick. Scrambling quarterback Ryan Fitzy.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're willing to sacrifice that at some times just to try to shut everything else down.
It definitely, and they basically gave up nothing to Kaepernick in week two. But they're not going to latch onto that in the same way that the Packers did. I think the Packers won in that game in week one with a terrible game plan. Yeah. I think they went into it with the absolute wrong perspective, just focusing on shutting down Colin Kaepernick and running the ball and wanting to hit him as hard as possible, and it ended up losing them that game.
Yeah, they overreacted, I think, to what happened in the playoffs, which is understandable. But it's the same sort of thing that we just talked about with the Seahawks and the Saints, where you know we want to run, so we're going to come out passing the ball. The interesting thing is, this is the first time that Kaepernick has played the Seahawks at whatever they're calling Candlestick Park these days.
Yeah, last time that Pete Carroll plays there also.
Hmm? Oh, yeah. But I was saying that previously his first two starts against the Seahawks.
Yeah. I'm just saying it's a notable game because it's the last time. We have a lot of connections to the 49ers.
It is definitely the last time. Obviously.
I don't think
there could be another matchup, but it would not be at Candlestick.
So that's an exciting moment, and we'll see how Colin Kaepernick responds to that. Right now, you would have to say that we kind of have his number. I mean, the combined score against Colin Kaepernick is not good.
But I think that playing in Seattle is a huge part of that, obviously. To state the obvious, the Seahawks are a better team at home.
Yes. So I think it'll be really interesting to see how he responds to that and to see how it could change people's perspectives of Colin Kaepernick this game.
What about on the other side of the football? What do you feel like is key against the San Francisco defense?
Key against the San Francisco defense, I think, is getting the run going in the same way that it is against any team. They have a really good defense, and making sure that you're able to kind of neutralize their pass rushers. Ahmad Brooks has had a really good season. They've been getting the pass rush going lately against Washington, you mentioned.
Yeah, it was the first time we saw Alden Smith really involved since he's come back from his suspension and trip to rehab. So, you know, I think that gives them a new element on defense. They're 22nd in adjusted sack rate, which is a huge disappointment for a team that was as good at bringing pressure as they were last year. But we might start seeing something more like that team of old if Alden Smith is a bigger factor.
Yeah, I think in the San Francisco secondary, they also haven't been able to kind of find... they have a really solid rookie in Eric Reed.
Yeah, he stepped in for Deshaun Goldson nicely there.
He's been really natural, but they have had some turnover and turmoil in the secondary. They cut Nnamdi Asamoah, who they signed over the offseason or traded for over the offseason.
It's a nickel corner spot that I think has really been problematic for them.
And so there are holes there, and I think that if the Seahawks can get the run game going and get the 49ers kind of focusing on that, they can do the same thing that they did at the Saints this last week.
I mean, the thing is, the Seahawks offense is sound such good balance that you don't really worry about them, you know, depending on specific matchups.
San Francisco will be the best defense that they've played, I believe, all season. I don't know.
Way, way better than when they played San Francisco the first time.
I mean, honestly, right now they probably are.
Yeah.
They probably are in the best place. By DVOA, San Francisco is the sixth best defense. I don't know if Houston was better when they played them. I highly doubt that. And Carolina was in week one, so they're still getting adjusted, having Star Lotelli and people like that. But really, when you have Marshawn Lynch, who, if he gets any space, can do something, Russell Wilson running the ball, and the ability to pass the ball, plus the potential of Percy Harvin playing, I really don't know how you can stop that offense.
I don't know if I feel like Harvin is going likely to be out there. There was a report today that he had, quote, a procedure done on his hip.
No, that was what Pete Carroll said yesterday.
Okay.
It was a cortisone shot.
Yeah, well, I thought the theory was PRP, the plasma.
That might have been. I don't think it was any real procedure, though. But that was what Pete Carroll said yesterday, and he said he was feeling really good.
Huh, well, okay. Well, that's...
On that show. Pete Carroll sounded very positive about the potential of Percy Harvin playing. An alliteration. Pete Carroll was positive about Percy Harvin playing. But there really isn't... I mean, honestly, can you think of a way, like, this is the game plan to stop the Seahawks right now?
No.
Since the Tampa Bay game?
I mean, it is funny to think, yeah.
All of those different things going. And then also, have to mention, with Jermaine Kearse being back out there, there's no noticeable letdown in wide receiver. Jermaine Kearse is just a legit... we were talking about this on the way home. He's basically the number two wide receiver on the team, with Doug Baldwin often playing in the slot.
And then Ricardo Lockett even comes in and makes a big catch along the sidelines on Monday night. So, yeah, just everything's working right now for the Seahawks offense.
I don't think... At no point were you there and said to yourself, we're really missing Percy Harvin.
No.
And Kearse is such a solid receiver. I mean, everybody they have is such a solid receiver, really. With Zach Miller with the big catch... Golden Tate's always great. Baldwin's perfect in the slot. And then Kearse on the outside is a pretty natural flanker.
One place that they may have missed Percy Harvin, kickoff returns. Robert Turbin was in there with Jeremy Lane, forced into a larger role in the secondary like we talked about last week. And then Kearse playing such a big role in offense. And yeah, Turbin is not that good at returning.
No, he's not a great kick returner. It would have been nice to have Percy Harvin in there, I agree. Because I think Kearse is a good kick returner. And I would have been interested to see maybe if they even would have put Golden Tate back there.
Well, even if you have Harvin soaking up a few more of those snaps, that may be enough to get Kearse back in that role. So
yeah, it could have been that if they needed big kick returns, they might have put one of those guys back there. But since they didn't need to have a big return with a big lead most of the game.
Yeah. So what do you feel like chances of winning this game? It's the first time the Seahawks have been the underdog all season long.
I was surprised by that. I always pick the lines in my head, along with Bill Simmons and Cousin Sal, and I picked Seahawks -4.5.
Wait, did they have a podcast this week?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed it.
And it was San Francisco -3, which I was kind of shocked about.
Yeah, I think that's one that, I don't know, it was at that point before the season, and it feels like it should have shifted slightly in favor of the Seahawks based on the way they've played the last few weeks.
Chances of victory, I would say 55%.
It was between 50 and 55. I hesitate. Vegas is good. I hesitate to like disagree with them too much. But
I was shocked by that line, to be honest. To see the 49ers favored, it's the only game that the Seahawks are not going to be favored in all season.
In all likelihood.
they might not be favored against the Giants.
No, I was thinking beyond the regular season, perhaps, let's say.
Okay, well, the only game on the schedule
that
they won't be favored in. But I do think, I think they're more likely to win than not, but not by a significant amount.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I mean, I think that they're a significantly better team in a neutral field. You play in San Francisco, that puts them on pretty even footing.
My Seahawks -4.5 was too big, but maybe it was kind of a pick, or the Seahawks -1. That's what I guess.
Yeah, that about matches up with 55% chance of winning.
Let's talk about tailgating.
Yeah, big weekend with the Apple Cup last week.
So we prepared for an epic Apple Cup tailgate.
Which, by the way, we have not even talked about that game because it feels like it was played 10 years ago.
The coach is gone. Everything is different. I completely forgot about that as being something to talk about.
What are you going to say? Like, oh yeah, Sark's system really worked well last week. Looked great in the second half.
Right when Coach Sark left, it was like the whole season never happened. Right? It would be nice to see Justin Wilcox have the opportunity to coach a bowl game, too.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other factor. It's like, who was even going to coach that bowl game if Wilcox goes to USC?
It would have been Tui.
Yeah, you got to figure he'll stay.
But let's go over. So it was such an epic tailgate. I have to outline what we drank, and I want to maybe rank them or at least talk about what we thought about them. Yeah. So I emailed you a list of what it was beforehand. And that was, do you want to read them?
Sierra Nevada Celebration Ale, Ballast Point Sculpin IPA, Rogue Juniper Pale Ale, which we actually had on Thanksgiving, not at the tailgate, Rogue Santa's Private Reserve.
Because it was Christmas.
Fremont Bonfire Winter Ale.
I thought that was pretty good.
Alaskan Winter Ale. And obviously Rainier both in the bottle and in the can.
Rainier in the bottle and Rainier in the can. For shotgunning. What did you think of those beers? I thought that they were, I mean, there's no stinker among the group.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. I think the Celebration was the one that was my favorite.
That was your winner? I think my winner might have been the Fremont Bonfire.
Yeah, that was also pretty good.
Normally, I'm a little bit down on Fremont beers, so I was deciding between the Fremont Bonfire, I ended up getting a 22-ounce bottle of it, versus the Fremont Abominable Ale. Those were just too expensive. They're 12-ounce cans, and it was like $8 for four of them. I was like, this is not, it just can't be worth it. So that was too expensive for me to get. So I went with the Fremont Bonfire Winter Ale because they have two winter ales at Fremont now. And I thought that might have been the best of the group. I do think that the Ballast Point Sculpin, it's one of the highest reviewed beers in the country, and I think it's a little bit overrated.
I tended to think that too.
I mean, who knows? By the time I had it, I'd had so much other stuff. So it all kind of tasted the same at that point. But
yeah, it's not proper conditions for like a taste test. You know, you're not swishing it around in your mouth and
spitting it out.
Yeah. You're definitely not spitting it out.
We were joking about people with marijuana in Seattle now. If they're going to start doing that taste testing, I was like, you'll smoke it in and then you'll blow it out. But I was wondering if people will become weed snobs in the way that people are beer snobs.
Oh, if there's anything that exists, you could become a snob at it.
I think that's going to happen. I'm excited for that. If I had to rank them, I would say I would put the Bonfire number one, followed by the Celebration, and then maybe the Santa's Private Reserve.
I would probably put, like I said, the Celebration number one. Maybe the Juniper Pale Ale. I kind of enjoyed that.
It was pretty good.
So
I would put Rainier in the bottle number one, followed by Rainier in the can.
wait, bottle over can?
And so we had...
That's a controversial ranking.
I always put the bottle over the can.
Oh, yeah, I'm getting those backed up.
Rainier in the bottle is always number one. But we had, I think, what was the count? I had to count this after we were drinking for like 5 hours, so I don't know if it was correct. I couldn't count it at all. I had to turn to you. 60 beers? I think it was a total of 60 beers, a fifth of liquor, and a bottle of Cook's champagne.
I think it was 66. I think it was 4 6-packs and then 42 of the Rainiers.
And we managed to drink all of it, plus a couple of pumpkin beers in there, too.
There were a lot of people there.
We were at 70. It was an epic tailgate.
It was.
It was the most beer that we've ever drank.
Especially before 12:38 p.m.
Yeah, for an early game. Holy cow. It was a great game, though, being there. I thought it was fun the whole time. From what I remember of it.
Well, you may not remember the first half, so yeah. That would make it a lot more fun. The first half wasn't so great.
I remember the second half quite well. We actually drank so much that we decided not to barbecue.
Yeah, well, also we ate so much at breakfast at like 8 a.m.
So yeah, we have no reviews of bratwurst with cream cheese.
The one thing, I don't know if you remember this, is grumbling at halftime, like we hired the wrong guy in 2008. We should have hired Leach instead of Sark. That came up at one point.
That we shouldn't have hired Sark. That's why I think it's a really funny conversation. Because throughout the season, we've had a lot of conversations about not being excited about Sark.
The highs and lows of the college football season.
And now that he won two games, now he's the greatest coach.
And that's why I rarely tweet during games.
Really? Do you think that he would have been hired? I'm constantly going back to this head coaching conversation. If he would have lost one of those two games, both of those two games, you think there's a chance that he gets hired at USC?
I think it's pretty hard to hire someone coming off a loss to Wazoo. But I don't know. They seem to be sold on him. Obviously, it didn't take them a long time to make the decision. So there was a lot of support from the boosters. I don't think you could have hired him if he was coming off a three-game winning losing streak.
Or if Ed Orgeron would have won against UCLA.
Again, they made the decision so fast that, I don't know.
They really kicked Ed Orgeron to the curb pretty quickly.
Ed Orgeron, I was reading the story about when Pete Carroll got hired at USC, the one coach he retained from the assistants.
Was Ed O?
Yep.
There you go. He does have the Pete Carroll seal of approval. Maybe I want him now.
Yeah.
So we'll follow up with the head coach when it happens.
Any thoughts on fantasy?
Let's talk about fantasy next week. We go into the playoffs. I'm in the playoffs. You're not in the playoffs. I don't want to bring up those bad feelings for you.
Yeah, I needed 16 points on Monday night from
Marcus Colston.
Marcus Colston, and he did not quite get there. I don't know if you noticed that watching the game.
Having Marcus Colston against the Seahawks wasn't you who needed those.
No, it was another game. But the good thing was at some point they got up by enough that I could freely root for 80-yard Marcus Colston touchdowns.
I kept thinking that during the game. I was like, why didn't Al play Marcus Colston against the Seahawks? I was like, oh, you didn't. You're cheering for somebody else's team to win.
Tough to have that outside of your control. Well, we should mention before we go here,
the Jermaine Kearse Vic Ballard comparison.
Yeah, do you have the box score from the Saints game?
Jermaine Kearse put up a 2.
A very solid 2. A professional 2. And Vic Ballard obviously got a 0.
Did not score.
Still out for the year. and Jermaine Kearse continues to lead that. So, go Jermaine.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.